This is Emily Kane, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I dedicate these readings to my dad, Dave Kane. The Paper Menagerie by Kin Lu. One of my earliest memories starts with me sobbing. I refused to be soothed, no matter what Mom and Dad tried. Dad gave up and left the bedroom, but Mom took me into the kitchen and sat me down at the breakfast table. "Kan Kan," she said, as she pulled a sheet of wrapping paper from on top of the fridge. For years, Mom carefully sliced open the wrappings around Christmas gifts and saved them on top of the fridge in a thick stack. She set the paper down, plain side facing up, and began to fold it. I stopped crying and watched her, curious. She turned the paper over and folded it again. She pleated, packed, tucked, rolled, and twisted until the paper disappeared between her cupped hands. Then, she lifted the folded-up paper packet to her mouth and blew into it like a balloon. "Kan," she said, "Lahu." She put her hands down on the table and let go. A little paper tiger stood on the table, the size of two fists placed together. The skin of the tiger was the pattern on the wrapping paper, white background with red candy canes and green Christmas trees. I reached out to Mom's creation. Its tail twitched, and it pounced playfully at my finger. "Rawr, saw," it growled, the sound somewhere between a cat and rustling newspapers. I laughed, startled, and stroked its back with an index finger. The paper tiger vibrated under my finger, purring. "Jijiao, jiji," Mom said. "This is called origami." I didn't know this at the time, but Mom's kind was special. She breathed into them so that they shared her breath and thus moved with her life. This was her magic. Dad had picked Mom out of a catalog. One time, when I was in high school, I asked Dad about the details. He was trying to get me to speak to Mom again. He had signed up for the introduction service back in the spring of 1973. Flipping through the pages steadily, he had spent no more than a few seconds on each page until he saw the picture of Mom. "I've never seen this picture," Dad described it. Mom was sitting in a chair, her side to the camera, wearing a tight green silk cheongsam. Her head was turned to the camera so that her long black hair was draped artfully over her chest and shoulder. She looked out at him with the eyes of a calm child. "That was the last page of the catalog I saw," he said. The catalog said she was 18, loved to dance, and spoke good English because she was from Hong Kong. None of these facts turned out to be true. He wrote to her, and the company passed their messages back and forth. Finally, he flew to Hong Kong to meet her. The people at the company had been writing her responses. She didn't know any English other than hello and goodbye. "What kind of woman puts herself into a catalog so that she can be bought?" The high school me thought I knew so much about everything. Contempt felt good, like wine. Instead of storming into the office to demand his money back, he paid a waitress at the hotel restaurant to translate for them. She would look at me, her eyes halfway between scared and hopeful, while I spoke. And when the girl began translating what I said, she'd start to smile slowly. He flew back to Connecticut and began to apply for the papers for her to come to him. I was born a year later, in the year of the tiger. At my request, Mom also made a goat, a deer, and a water buffalo out of wrapping paper. They would run around the living room while Lahu chased after them, growling. When he caught them, he would press down until the air went out of them and they became just flat, folded-up pieces of paper. I would then have to blow into them to reinflate them so they could run around some more. Sometimes the animals got into trouble. Once, the water buffalo jumped into a dish of soy sauce on the table at dinner. He wanted to wallow, like a real water buffalo. I picked him out quickly, but the capillary action had already pulled the dark liquid high up into his legs. The sauce-softened legs would not hold him up, and he collapsed onto the table. I dried him out in the sun, but his legs became crooked after that, and he ran around with a limp. Mom eventually wrapped his legs in saran wrap so that he could wallow to his heart's content. Just not in soy sauce. Also, Lauhu liked to pounce at sparrows when he and I played in the backyard. But one time, a cornered bird struck back in desperation and tore his ear. He whimpered and winced as I held him, and Mom patched his ear together with tape. He avoided birds after that. And then one day, I saw a TV documentary about sharks and asked Mom for one of my own. She made the shark, but he flapped about on the table unhappily. I filled the sink with water and put him in. He swam around and around happily. However, after a while, he became soggy and translucent and slowly sank to the bottom, the folds coming undone. I reached in to rescue him, and all I ended up with was a wet piece of paper. Lauhu put his front paws together at the edge of the sink and rested his head on them. Ears drooping, he made a low growl in his throat that made me feel guilty. Mom made a new shark for me, this time out of tin foil. The shark lived happily in a large goldfish bowl. Lauhu and I liked to sit next to the bowl to watch the tinfoil shark chasing the goldfish, Lauhu sticking his face up against the bowl on the other side so that I saw his eyes, magnified to the size of coffee cups, staring at me from across the bowl. When I was 10, we moved to a new house across town. Two of the women neighbors came by to welcome us. Dad served them drinks and then apologized for having to run off to the utility company to straighten out the prior owner's bills. "Make yourselves at home. My wife doesn't speak much English, so don't think she's being rude for not talking to you." While I read in the dining room, Mom unpacked in the kitchen. The neighbors conversed in the living room, not trying to be particularly quiet. "He seems like a normal enough man. Why did he do that?" "Something about the mixing never seems right. The child looks unfinished. Slanty eyes, white face, a little monster." "Do you think he can speak English?" The women hushed. After a while, they came into the dining room. "Hello there. What's your name?" "Jack," I said. "That doesn't sound very Chinesey." Mom came into the dining room then. She smiled at the women. The three of them stood in a triangle around me, smiling and nodding at each other, with nothing to say until Dad came back. Mark, one of the neighborhood boys, came over with his Star Wars action figures. Obi-Wan Kenobi's lightsaber lit up, and he could swing his arms and say in a tinny voice, "Use the Force!" I didn't think the figure looked much like the real Obi-Wan at all. Together, we watched him repeat this performance 5 times on the coffee table. "Can he do anything else?" I asked. Mark was annoyed by my question. "Look at all the details," he said. I looked at the details. I wasn't sure what I was supposed to say. Mark was disappointed by my response. "Show me your toys." I didn't have any toys except my paper menagerie. I brought Lauhu out from my bedroom. By then he was very worn, patched all over with tape and glue, evidence of the years of repairs Mom and I had done on him. He was no longer as nimble and sure-footed as before. I sat him down on the coffee table. I could hear the skittering steps of the other animals behind in the hallway, timidly peeking into the living room. "Xiao Lauhu," I said, and stopped. I switched to English. "This is Tiger." Cautiously, Lauhu strode up and purred at Mark, sniffing his hands. Mark examined the Christmas wrap pattern of Lauhu's skin. "That doesn't look like a tiger at all. Your mom makes toys for you from trash?" I had never thought of Lauhu as trash, but looking at him now, he really just was a piece of wrapping paper. Mark pushed Obi-Wan's head again. The lightsaber flashed. He moved his arms up and down. "Use the Force!" Lauhu turned and pounced, knocking the plastic figure off the table. It hit the floor and broke, and Obi-Wan's head rolled under the couch. "Rawr!" Lauhu laughed. I joined him. Mark punched me hard. This was very expensive. You can't even find it in the stores now. It probably costs more than what your dad paid for your mom. I stumbled and fell to the floor. Lahu growled and leapt at Mark's face. Mark screamed, more out of fear and surprise than pain. Lahu was only made out of paper, after all. Mark grabbed Lahu and his snarl was choked off as Mark crumpled him in his hand and tore him in half. He balled up the two pieces of paper and threw them at me. Here's your stupid, cheap Chinese garbage. After Mark left, I spent a long time trying, without success, to tape together the pieces, smooth out the paper, and follow the creases to refold Lahu. Slowly, the other animals came into the living room and gathered around us, me and the torn wrapping paper that used to be Lahu. My fight with Mark didn't end there. Mark was popular at school. I never want to think again about the 2 weeks that followed. I came home that Friday at the end of the 2 weeks. "Xie Xiao, how ma?" Mom asked. I said nothing and went to the bathroom. I looked into the mirror. I look nothing like her. Nothing. At dinner, I asked Dad, "Do I have a chink face?" Dad put down his chopsticks. Even though I had never told him what happened in school, he seemed to understand. He closed his eyes and rubbed the bridge of his nose. "No, you don't." Mom looked at Dad, not understanding. She looked back at me. "Sha chao chink?" "English," I said. "Speak English." She tried. "What happened?" I pushed the chopsticks and the bowl before me away. Stir-fried green peppers with 5-spice beef. "We should eat American food," Dad tried to reason. "A lot of families cook Chinese sometimes." "We are not other families," I looked at him. "Other families don't have moms who don't belong." He looked away, and then he put a hand on Mom's shoulder. "I'll get you a cookbook." Mom turned to me. "Bu hao chi?" "English," I said, raising my voice. "Speak English." Mom reached out to touch my forehead, feeling for my temperature. "Fa sha la?" I brushed her hand away. "I'm fine! Speak English!" I was shouting. "Speak English to him," Dad said to Mom. "You knew this was going to happen someday. What did you expect?" Mom dropped her hands to her side. She sat, looking from Dad to me and back to Dad again. She tried to speak, stopped, and tried again. And stopped again. "You have to," Dad said. "I've been too easy on you. Jack needs to fit in." Mom looked at him. "If I say love, I feel here." She pointed to her lips. "If I say I feel here." She put her hand over her heart. Dad shook his head. "You are in America." Mom hunched down in her seat, looking like the water buffalo when Lahu used to pounce on him and squeeze the air of life out of him. "And I want some real toys." Dad bought me a full set of Star Wars action figures. I gave the Obi-Wan Kenobi to Mark. I packed the paper menagerie in a large shoebox and put it under the bed. The next morning, the animals had escaped and took over their old favorite spots in my room. I caught them all and put them back into the shoebox, taping the lid shut. But the animals made so much noise in the box that I finally shoved it into the corner of the attic as far away from my room as possible. If Mom spoke to me in Chinese, I refused to answer her. After a while, she tried to use more English, but her accent and broken sentences embarrassed me. I tried to correct her. Eventually, she stopped speaking altogether if I was around. Mom began to mime things if she needed to let me know something. She tried to hug me the way she saw American mothers did on TV. I thought her movements exaggerated, uncertain, ridiculous, graceless. She saw that I was annoyed and stopped. "You shouldn't treat your mother that way," Dad said. But he couldn't look me in the eyes as he said it. Deep in his heart, he must have realized that it was a mistake to have tried to take a Chinese peasant girl and expect her to fit into the suburbs of Connecticut. Mom learned to cook American style. I played video games and studied French. Every once in a while, I would see her at the kitchen table, studying the plain side of a sheet of wrapping paper. Later, a new paper animal would appear on my nightstand and try to cuddle up to me. I caught them, squeezed them until the air went out of them, and then stuffed them away in the box in the attic. Mom finally stopped making the animals when I went to high school. By then, her English was much better, but I was already at the age when I wasn't interested in what she had to say, whatever language she used. Sometimes, when I came home and saw her tiny body busily moving about in the kitchen, singing a song in Chinese to herself, it was hard for me to believe that she gave birth to me. We had nothing in common. She might as well be from the moon. I would hurry on to my room, where I could continue my all-American pursuit of happiness. Dad and I stood, one on each side of Mom lying in her hospital bed. She was not yet even 40, but she looked much older. For years, she had refused to go to the doctor for the pain inside her that she said was no big deal. By the time an ambulance finally carried her in, the cancer had spread far beyond the limits of surgery. My mind was not in the room. It was in the middle of the on-campus recruiting season, and I was focused on resumes, transcripts, and strategically constructed interview schedules. I schemed about how to lie to the corporate recruiters most effectively so that they'd offer to buy me. I understood intellectually that it was terrible to think about this while your mother lay dying, but that understanding didn't mean I could change how I felt. She was conscious. Dad held her left hand with both of his own. He leaned down to kiss her forehead. He seemed weak and old in a way that startled me. I realized that I knew almost as little about Dad as I did about Mom. Mom smiled at him. "I'm fine." She turned to me, still smiling. "I know you have to go back to school." Her voice was very weak, and it was difficult to hear her over the hum of the machines hooked up to her. "Go. Don't worry about me. This is not a big deal. Just do well in school." I reached out to touch her hand, because I thought that was what I was supposed to do. I was relieved. I was already thinking about the flight back and the bright California sunshine. She whispered something to Dad. He nodded and left the room. "Jack, if..." She was caught up in a fit of coughing and could not speak for some time. "If I don't make it, don't be too sad and hurt your health. Focus on your life. Just keep that box you have in the attic with you. And every year, at Qingming, just take it out and think about me. I'll be with you always." Qingming was the Chinese festival for the dead. When I was very young, Mom used to write a letter on Qingming to her dead parents back in China, telling them the good news about the past year of her life in America. She would read the letter out loud to me, and if I made a comment about something, she would write it down in the letter, too. Then she would fold the letter into a paper crane and release it, facing west. We would then watch as the crane flapped its crisp wings on its long journey west, toward the Pacific, toward China, toward the graves of Mom's family. It had been many years since I last did that with her. "I don't know anything about the Chinese calendar," I said. "Just rest, Mom. Just keep the box with you and open it once in a while. Just open." She began to cough again. "It's okay, Mom." I stroked her arm awkwardly. "Haizi, mama ai ni." Her cough took over again. An image from years ago flashed into my memory. Mom saying "ai," and then putting her hand over her heart. "All right, Mom, stop talking." Dad came back, and I said that I needed to get to the airport early because I didn't want to miss my flight. She died when my plane was somewhere over Nevada. Dad aged rapidly after Mom died. The house was too big for him and had to be sold. My girlfriend, Susan, and I went to help him pack and clean the place. Susan found the shoebox in the attic, the paper menagerie, hidden in the uninsulated darkness of the attic for so long, had become brittle, and the bright wrapping paper patterns had faded. "I've never seen origami like this," Susan said. "Your mom was an amazing artist." The paper animals did not move. Perhaps whatever magic had animated them stopped when Mom died. Or perhaps I had only imagined that these paper constructions were once alive. The memory of children could not be trusted. It was the first weekend in April, 2 years after Mom's death. Susan was out of town on one of her endless trips as a management consultant, and I was home, lazily flipping through the TV channels. I paused at a documentary about sharks. Suddenly I saw, in my mind, Mom's hands as they folded and refolded tinfoil to make a shark for me while Lauhu and I watched. A rustle. I looked up and saw that a ball of wrapping paper and torn tape was on the floor next to the bookshelf. I walked over to pick it up for the trash. The ball of paper shifted, unfurled itself, and I saw that it was Lauhu, who I hadn't thought about in a very long time. "Rarsa!" Mom must have put him back together after I had given up. He was smaller than I remembered. Or maybe it was just that back then, my fists were smaller. Susan had put the paper animals around our apartment as decorations. She probably left Lauhu in a pretty hidden corner because he looked so shabby. I sat down on the floor and reached out a finger. Lauhu's tail twitched, and he pounced playfully. I laughed, stroking his back. Lauhu purred under my hand. "How have you been, old buddy?" Lauhu stopped playing. He got up, jumped with feline grace into my lap, and proceeded to unfold himself. In my lap was a square of creased wrapping paper, the plain side up. It was filled with dense Chinese characters. I had never learned to read Chinese, but I knew the characters for sun, and they were at the top, where you'd expect them in a letter addressed to you, written in Mom's awkward, childish handwriting. I went to the computer to check the internet. Today was Qingming. I took the letter with me downtown, where I knew the Chinese tour buses stopped. I stopped every tourist, asking, "Nin hui du chongwen ma?" "Can you read Chinese?" I hadn't spoken Chinese in so long that I wasn't sure if they understood. A young woman agreed to help. We sat down on a bench together, and she read the letter to me aloud. The language that I had tried to forget for years came back, and I felt the words sinking into me, through my skin, through my bones, until they squeezed tight around my heart. "Son, we haven't talked in a long time. You are so angry when I try to touch you that I'm afraid. And I think maybe this pain I feel all the time now is something serious. So I decided to write to you. I'm going to write in the paper animals I made for you that you used to like so much. The animals will stop moving when I stop breathing. But if I write to you with all my heart, I'll leave a little of myself behind on this paper in these words. Then, if you think of me on Qingming, when the spirits of the departed are allowed to visit their families, you'll make the parts of myself I leave behind come alive too. The creatures I made for you will again leap and run and pounce, and maybe you'll get to see these words then. Because I have to write with all my heart, I need to write to you in Chinese. All this time, I still haven't told you the story of my life. When you were little, I always thought I'd tell you the story when you were older so you could understand. But somehow, that chance never came up. I was born in 1957 in Sugulu Village, Hebei Province. Your grandparents were both from very poor peasant families with few relatives. Only a few years after I was born, the Great Famine struck China, during which 30 million people died. The first memory I have was waking up to see my mother eating dirt so that she could fill her belly and leave the last bit of flour for me. Things got better after that. Sugulu is famous for its jiaji paper craft, and my mother taught me how to make paper animals and give them life. This was practical magic in the life of the village. We made paper birds to chase grasshoppers away from the fields and paper tigers to keep away the mice. For Chinese New Year, my friends and I made red paper dragons. I'll never forget the sight of all those little dragons zooming across the sky overhead, holding up strings of exploding firecrackers to scare away all the bad memories of the past year. You would have loved it. Then came the Cultural Revolution in 1966. Neighbor turned on neighbor, and brother against brother. Someone remembered that my mother's brother, my uncle, had left for Hong Kong back in 1946 and became a merchant there. Having a relative in Hong Kong meant we were spies and enemies of the people, and we had to be struggled against in every way. Your poor grandmother, she couldn't take the abuse and threw herself down a well. Then some boys with hunting muskets dragged your grandfather away one day into the woods, and he never came back. There I was, a 10-year-old orphan. The only relative I had in the world was my uncle in Hong Kong. I snuck away one night and climbed onto a freight train going south. Down in Guangdong Province a few days later, some men caught me stealing food from a field. When they heard that I was trying to get to Hong Kong, they laughed. It's your lucky day. Our trade is to bring girls to Hong Kong. They hid me in the bottom of a truck, along with other girls, and smuggled us across the border. We were taken to a basement and told to stand up and look healthy and intelligent for the buyers. Families paid the warehouse a fee and came by to look us over and select one of us to adopt. The Chin family picked me to take care of their two boys. I got up every morning at 4 to prepare breakfast. I fed and bathed the boys. I shopped for food. I did the laundry and swept the floors. I followed the boys around and did their bidding. At night, I was locked into a cupboard in the kitchen to sleep. If I was slow or did anything wrong, I was beaten. If the boys did anything wrong, I was beaten. If I was caught trying to learn English, I was beaten. "Why do you want to learn English?" Mr. Chin asked. "You want to go to the police? We'll tell the police that you are a mainlander illegally in Hong Kong. They'd love to have you in their prison." 6 years I lived like this. One day, an old woman who sold fish to me in the morning market pulled me aside. "I know girls like you. How old are you now, 16? One day, the man who owns you will get drunk, and he'll look at you and pull you to him, and you can't stop him. The wife will find out, and then you will think you really have gone to hell. You have to get out of this life. I know someone who can help." She told me about American men who wanted Asian wives. "If I can cook, clean, and take care of my American husband, he'll give me a good life." It was the only hope I had. And that was how I got into the catalog with all those lies and met your father. It is not a very romantic story, but it is my story. In the suburbs of Connecticut, I was lonely. Your father was kind and gentle with me, and I was very grateful to him. But no one understood me, and I understood nothing. But then you were born. I was so happy when I looked into your face and saw shades of my mother, my father, and myself. I had lost my entire family, all of Sugulu, everything I ever knew and loved. But there you were, and your face was proof that they were real. I hadn't made them up. Now I had someone to talk to. I would teach you my language, and we could together remake a small piece of everything that I loved and lost. When you said your first words to me, in Chinese, that it had the same accent as my mother and me, I cried for hours. When I made the first jiaji animals for you, and you laughed, I felt there were no worries in the world. You grew up a little, and now you could even help your father and I talk to each other. I was really at home now. I finally found a good life. I wished my parents could be here so that I could cook for them and give them a good life too. But my parents were no longer around. You know what the Chinese think is the saddest feeling in the world? It's for a child to finally grow the desire to take care of his parents, only to realize that they were long gone. Son, I know that you do not like your Chinese eyes, which are my eyes. I know that you do not like your Chinese hair, which is my hair. But can you understand how much joy your very existence brought to me? And can you understand how it felt when you stopped talking to me and won't let me talk to you in Chinese? I felt I was losing everything all over again. Why won't you talk to me, son? The pain makes it hard to write. The young woman handed the paper back to me. I could not bear to look into her face. Without looking up, I asked for her help in tracing out the character for I on the paper below Mom's letter. I wrote the character again and again on the paper, intertwining my pen strokes with her words. The young woman reached out and put a hand on my shoulder. Then she got up and left, leaving me alone with my mother. Following the creases, I refolded the paper back into Lao Hu. I cradled him in the crook of my arm, and as he purred, we began the walk home. This is volunteer reader Emily Kane. Open House on Haunted Hill by John Wiswell. 133 Poisonwood Avenue would be stronger if it was a killer house. There is an estate at 35 Silver Street that annihilated a family back in the 1800s, and its roof has never sprung a leak since. In 2007, it still had the power to trap a bickering couple in an endless hedge maze that was physically only 300 square feet. 35 Silver Street is a show-off. 133 Poisonwood only ever had one person ever die under its roof. Back in 1989, Dory Toya Blasco had refused hospice and spent 2.5 months enjoying the sound of the wind on 133 Poisonwood's shingles. 133 Poisonwood played its heart out for her every day. The house misses 1989. It has spent so much of the time since vacant. Today, it is going to change that. It is on its best behavior as the realtor, Mrs. Weiss, sweeps up. She puts out trays of store-bought cookies and hides scent dispensers, while 133 Poisonwood summons a gentle breeze and uses its aura to spook any groundhogs off the property. Both the realtor and the real estate need this open house to work. Stragglers trickle in. They are bored people, more interested in snacks than the restored plumbing. The house straightens its aching floorboards, like a human sucking in their belly. Stragglers track mud everywhere. The house would love nothing more than any of them to spend the rest of their lives tracking mud into it. A heavy-set man with sagging shoulders lets himself in. He has a bit of brownie smudged against the back of his parakeet green hoodie and doesn't seem aware of it. Mrs. Weiss gives him a little wave while continuing to hold up a 10-minute conversation with an affluent couple. The couple made the mistake of saying they were thinking of conceiving, and Mrs. Weiss wields stats about the school district like a cowboy wields a lasso. The couple's shoes likely cost more than a down payment on the house, but from how often they check their phones, they're clearly headed back to their Mercedes. The man with the brownie-stained hoodie prowls through 133 Poisonwood's halls, and it pulls its floorboards so straight that its foundations tremble. The man doesn't look at 133 Poisonwood's floor. He looks at the couple of ripples in the green floral wallpaper with the expression of someone looking at his own armpit. The house feels ashamed of the loose wallpaper. It's vintage painted silk, which Mrs. Weiss says could be a big value add. Now the house ponders if it can haunt its own glue and help strip the wallpaper away to please him. It's especially important since he is spending more time here than anyone has yet without Mrs. Weiss wrangling them. It's like he doesn't feel the vibes other visitors do, or he doesn't care about them. From his behavior, what he cares about is wallpaper, the natural lighting through the windows in the master bedroom, and the kitchen. A child stomps in through the front door, her frizzy hair and three oblong pigtails she probably did herself. A silver keepsake locket clashes with her bright green Incredible Hulk t-shirt. Her elbows are tucked into her chest, hands out like claws, stained with brownie bits. Every step she takes is deliberate and channels all her tiny body weight to be as heavy as possible. If the house had to guess, the girl is probably pretending to be a dinosaur on the hunt. The man in the brownie-stained hoodie glances at her. He asks, "Anna, where's your coat?" Anna bellows, "I hate clothes!" Anna apparently hates clothes so much, she immediately grabs the bottom of her Hulk t-shirt and yanks it up over her head. She is careful to keep her locket in place, but chucks the shirt at the man. He grabs for her, and she ducks between his arms, bolting past Mrs. Weiss and the affluent couple, pigtails and locket bouncing. In their chase, they leave the front door open. The house knows heating oil is expensive. It summons a spectral breeze to shut it for them. The sound makes Anna pinwheel around, and she points at the door. She says, "Daddy, it's ghosts!" Daddy says, "Anna, we talked about this. There's no such thing as ghosts. You didn't look. You don't have to look for things that aren't there." Anna looks at her locket and huffs. "What if it's Mommy's ghost?" Daddy closes his eyes for a moment. "Please just put your shirt back on." Anna immediately attacks her own pants. "Clothes are for the weak." "Put it on or we are leaving, Anna," he says, trying to wrestle clothing onto his daughter. She pushes at him, leaving more brownie residue on his hoodie. As they battle, the affluent couple slips out the front door without closing it. The house closes it for them. Heating oil isn't cheap. The triangular roof means the second floor only has the space for one bedroom. Mrs. Weiss reads the expression on Daddy's face, and she attacks with, "The basement is very spacious, with generous lighting. It's cool in the summer and toasty in the winter." Anna says, "Heights are bad luck anyway." The four-year-old scarcely looks at the bedroom before backing out. She holds the handrail with both hands as she climbs down the stairs on quivering legs. On the third stair, she freezes entirely. Daddy is in the middle of surveying the room and misses Anna quivering in place. Some houses give their residents visions of slaughters or trauma. 133 Poisonwood gives Daddy a swift vision of his daughter's vertigo. He doesn't know it's anyone else's insight and wouldn't believe it, but he's at the stairs in seconds. Anna holds onto his pants leg until she feels safe. All 133 Poisonwood has is a light touch, but it knows how to use it. Haunting is an art. The basement is only half underground, so the windows are level with the freshly mowed front lawn. Anna spends a moment giggling at the view. Then she whizzes around the basement, from the combination furnace and laundry room to a storage closet and to a pair of vacant rooms. They would make a perfect child's bedroom and playroom. Anna goes to the west room, announcing, "Daddy, you can keep all the ghosts you bust in here." Mrs. Weiss offers, "One of these could be a home office. You said you'd telecommute? Google Fiber is coming to the area next year." Daddy says, I want to work from home more. I'm a software engineer, and I host a Skeptic podcast. You might have heard us. The house isn't offended. It doesn't believe in ghosts either. Anna hops back and forth between the two rooms, scrutinizing over and over as though they'll grow. That is a trick the house doesn't have. Daddy says, "We could sleep next door to each other. What do you think?" Anna says, "But I want a big dino room." "You're going to be a big dinosaur. How about the room on the top floor?" Anna's bottom lip shoots upward like she's going to run. She clearly won't settle for the room on the top floor, and there's only a master bedroom on the first floor. A tantrum is close, and it could ruin everything. So 133 Poisonwood plays its ace. Every decent haunted house has at least one secret room. Dorieta Blasco used to sew down here when she didn't want to be pestered, in a room her family couldn't find. It would be a perfect place for Anna to grow up in. Perhaps she'll learn to sew. With the sound of an affectionate kitten, the door opens. Shock hits the adults, who definitely don't remember there being a room there. Anna doesn't care and runs to explore it. We aren't showing that room, Mrs. Weiss says, scrambling to cover for herself. She's panicking, imagining hazards and lawsuits. She doesn't understand. 133 Poisonwood is going to clinch the sale for them. The room runs deep, with an expansive window that hasn't been seen from the outside in over 20 years. A sewing box with a scarlet and royal blue quilted exterior sits next to a rocking chair, and beneath the window is a broad spinning wheel that still smells like hobbies. Many great dresses were supposed to come out of this room. There are a few cracks on the concrete floor. Nothing a loving father can't fill in to perfect his daughter's big dino room. "Anna," Daddy calls, "stay near me." Anna ignores the call and runs straight up to the spinning wheel. Her little hands grab onto spokes in the drive wheel, and she turns to the door. "It's like Mommy's." Daddy says, "Careful, that's not ours." Anna yanks the wheel around to show it off to the adults. She pulls before the house can resist, and the entire device creaks and wobbles. It topples straight down on top of Anna, throwing her to the floor. Daddy grabs her shoulders and pulls her from between the cracked wheel and treadle. Anna's too distracted, bawling, to feel her necklace snag the spindle. The thin chain snaps, and the locket slips from her neck and down a crack in the floor. Without intending to, the house sucks down the chain like a strand of spaghetti. The house tries to spit it out. Daddy squeezes Anna to his chest so hard she could pop and keeps repeating, "Are you all right? Are you all right?" Mrs. Weiss gestures and says, "Her hand. Are you all right?" Anna says, "Let me fix it." She stretches her hands to the broken spinning wheel. One of her hands is bleeding, and she still wants to use them to clean up her mess. She says, "Daddy, let go. I'll fix it. Don't make the ghost sad." That breaks Daddy's concerned trance, and he lifts her under one arm, ignoring the kicking of her feet. He marches for the stairs. "No, I warned you, and we are leaving." "Daddy, no!" "No more. Say goodbye." "You see, the ghosts aren't saying goodbye. Do you know why?" An urge falls over the house to slam the door shut and trap them all inside. Daddy, Anna, and even Mrs. Weiss force them all to spend eternity in its hidden room, where they can make dresses and stay cool in the summer and warm in the winter. It will shelter them from all the hurricanes the world can create. It needs them. The phantom door's hinges and knob tremble as 133 Poisonwood fights itself. In that moment, it knows what makes other homes go evil. The killer houses can't bear to be alone. 133 Poisonwood Avenue would be stronger if it were a killer house. But it isn't one. It leaves its rooms open as Daddy carries his bawling daughter out of the basement, her incoherent sounds resonating through the house's crawl spaces. He carries her up the stairs and out the front door without a backward glance. This time, he remembers to close the door. 133 Poisonwood leaves the secret room open in the hopes that someone will come back. It squeezes the cracks in its floor closed, popping the locket out without scratching it. Inside is the picture of a woman with a thick nose and proud eyes. She would have made an excellent ghost. The house would take a phantom for an inhabitant at this point. The afternoon is sluggish. There are four more visitors, none of whom stay long enough to check the basement for treasure. The hours chug by, and Mrs. Weiss spends most of the time on her phone. With half an hour of daylight left, a red sedan pulls up. The driver lingers outside for 2 minutes before knocking. It's Daddy. Mrs. Weiss answers and forces a smile. Ulysses, is Anna okay? Daddy says, it was a scratch. Thanks for being understanding before. She says, I'm so sorry about that. I told the team this place was supposed to be empty. He says, have you seen a locket? Anna wears it everywhere, and it's gone missing. Mrs. Weiss holds the door open for him. We can check around. What does it look like? It has a picture of Anna's mother inside. It's one of the few gifts she still has from her. She was your wife? She was going to be, he says, and looks around the master bedroom with an expression even emptier than the space. There was an accident on our apartment's fire escape. She had a fall. Oh, that's terrible. Right now, Anna needs all the comfort she can get, so if we can find that locket, it'd save our lives. They look around, the man so tired, every step looks heavy. It's amazing he could stagger into a motel bed, let alone go hunting for a locket. The house hasn't seen someone as in need of a home in years. Mrs. Weiss says, I had something like that after my father passed away. Makes her feel like her mother's spirit is still with her. Superstitions aren't comforting to me, he says, fatigue giving way to scorn, as though daring the house's walls to do something. And Anna's mother was an atheist. The house is tempted to give Daddy the shock of his life and toss the locket to him, give him back the image of his lover and proof of its power. But he doesn't need to believe in hauntings. With his slumped shoulders and his clothes stained with his daughter's food and the pieces of their lives he's trying to put together, what he needs is a win. So the house uses what little strength it has to levitate the locket onto the top basement stair. It twists it so that the light catches it and shines into the upstairs living room. Daddy finds the precious locket on his own. He bends over it, brushing a thumb over his lover's image. He heaves a sigh through his nose, like he wishes he could fit inside the locket. The house lets him be proud of himself. It will hold on to this memory for the cold years ahead until it is bulldozed. Daddy stands up without the locket, leaving it behind. The house tries to send him a vision, warning that he's forgotten what he came here for. The mental image doesn't change what he's doing. He goes right outside to his sedan where Anna sits, rubbing at her puffy eyes and running nose. Daddy says, it might be here. Do you want to help me look? The house cannot cry. There is just a little air in its pipes. Anna flops out of the car and trudges into 133 Poisonwood. She spends too long poking around the kitchen, a room she was barely in earlier. Daddy plays an even worse sleuth, deliberately checking around empty hallways that give him a view of when Anna finally checks the basement door. Mommy! She cheers. She sits right down on the stair and hugs the locket to her throat, voice trembling with emotions too big for her body. Mommy came back! Daddy asks, so you found it? I told you she'd be here. Mommy wanted me to find it. Your mother didn't do that, Anna. She scrunches her nose and mimics his voice to say, you don't know that. Daddy puts a hand over the locket. You found this, not anybody else. You don't need ghosts. And he taps her on the temple, because you have the best parts of your mother inside you. Anna gazes up at her father with glossy eyes. 133 Poisonwood has never so understood what it wants to do for people as when it watches this parent. It tries to hold on to the vibrations of his voice and its walls. Then Anna says, "Nah, the ghost left it here." She hauls off to the living room, hopping in late afternoon sunbeams and holding the locket in the light. Reason is defeated for the moment. Daddy doesn't fight her on it. He rests against the wallpaper he hates, taking the house for granted. The house plays a tune on its shingles, the same one that calmed Blasco in 1989. Daddy calls, "Mrs. Weiss?" "Please, call me Carol," she says. She's been pretending she wasn't lurking 10 feet away this whole time. "You're very sweet with Anna. You can just tell some people were born with the knack." 3 rooms in the basement. This is a lot of house for the money, isn't it? It's just a family short of a home. 133 Poisonwood would be more charmed by the line if it hadn't heard her say that 8 other times today. Daddy says, "I like the space this place has for her. There's plenty of room to run, and she loves to run. Going to be a track and field star." "I said to myself that this place looks happier when you're in it. It suits you." The house can tell he wants to say he doesn't believe that. He says, "What we need is somewhere to start fresh." Mrs. Weiss offers him a folio of data on the house and gestures to the basement. "Care for another look around?" "Yeah, thank you." He takes the folio. "While Anna is playing upstairs, can we check how insulated from sound that sewing room is? It's funny, but I thought it might make a good podcast studio." If houses could laugh. He sounds so unguarded and sincere. This tired skeptic doesn't need to know that his podcast room doesn't technically exist. If he finds the blueprints for 133 Poisonwood, he'll shave away what he doesn't understand with Occam's razor. The house doesn't need him to believe in anything but himself and his daughter. It isn't here for the gratitude. It can try to support him as well as he supports Anna. If anything is as patient as a parent, it's a haunting. Black Licorice by British author Laura Shipler Chico. Her father held her small, plump hand as they walked through the tunnel that separated the foreigner's compound from the world outside. She stepped out of the dark with a thrill, following her father onto the gray Moscow street. Outside walking, others might think she was Russian. Her pale, smooth face, the flush of red on her cheeks. Her father, too, with his fur hat, his heavy coat, although his loose, confident gait might give him away. She had to run to keep up with her father's strides. He glanced at his watch, picked up his pace, his hand keeping hers warm. There was already a crowd gathering, and they joined the press of people outside the puppet theater, her red coat a splash of color against the coats of the others, and the dirty brown of the Stark building looming before them. The crowd was not there to pay to go inside to see a show. They were there to see the clock. The little girl looked up, pushing the hood off of her head. She had been there just once before, but it wasn't how she remembered it. It wasn't a circle, but an angular, asymmetrical wheel, with a square center and an iron arm stretching out for each hour. At the end of each spoke, there was a closed, triangular door. The gathering grew, jostling, and she could no longer see. Her father scooped her up and set her on his shoulders. From there, she could survey the crowd and look at the clock, trying to guess what was behind each door. She pictured the green cuckoo shouting out on its wooden plank, the red and white bear with cymbals, the painted clown, the brown dog playing the violin, and the ballerina spinning. They waited for the clock to strike 12, the one time in the day when all the doors would open at once. Their waiting made time sluggish, stretching out into the spaces in between. The girl shifted, her feet numb, and looked down at the crowd. Her toes gripped her boots, willing them not to fall off as her feet dangled over her father's shoulders. Mothers were tightening children's scarves and scolding in Russian. Fathers were pointing, children on tiptoe were maneuvering to get a better view. Her stomach rumbled. She fingered the soft fur of her father's hat. Somewhere, there was a baby crying. She noticed a girl just below her. She had a large pink bow in her hair. She imagined the girl going home when it was over, arriving to a burst of warmth hidden behind a drab, indifferent door and the smell of lunch simmering in the kitchen. And then she saw the boy. He was older than she was, 8, maybe 9. He was chewing a stick of black licorice, and in his other hand he held a second stick. She watched him as he slowly savored the sticky sweet. He licked his lips and tore off another piece with his teeth. She swallowed and stared. Maybe he felt her eyes on him. He looked up, wiping his mouth with the sleeve of his coat, and stared right back. He took another bite. Then, with dawning understanding, his face softened. Suddenly, his hand burst upwards, offering his second stick of licorice to her. Oh! She leaned eagerly down from her father's shoulders, reaching for the gift. But just at that moment, just before her hands could close around the offering, the clock struck. Her father, unaware, moved toward the clock, away from the boy, to give her a better view. With each strike of the clock, a door was opening, and the next and the next. People were clapping, a collective intake of breath with each new surprise, and then a great cheer when all the doors were open. She kept craning her neck, looking behind her for the boy with the licorice. But he was lost in the sea of upturned faces, watching as the clock blossomed out into the day. He was gone. They walked back, her father chatting happily about the clock. She squeezed his hand. Her mouth felt hollow, her chest full. She stepped lightly, though, with more intent. She didn't know that this new yearning would forever live inside her now, that she would always sense that each stranger had something sweet to offer up to the world, that she would always crave the sharp taste of licorice on her tongue.
This is Emily Kane, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.